All right, Luke 16 is where we'll be this morning. Luke chapter 16. Starting in verse 11. And I brought my, the Common English Version this morning. Luke chapter 16 in verses 11 through 14. If you haven't been faithful with worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? If you haven't been faithful with someone else's property, who will give you your own? No household servant can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be loyal to the one and have contempt for the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. And it says mammon in most versions. The Pharisees, who were money lovers, heard all this and sneered at Jesus. Man and a woman had been married for 65 years, and you know how those things happen, those love stories, romance stories. They both died within hours of each other. And of course, immediately they met in heaven, and they just took a tour of heaven. And they were just, the woman was just in awe of everything there, the beautiful mansions, the golden gates, the golden streets, all of these beautiful things. Heaven was just the most magnificent thing ever. And she was just effusing over it the whole time, and the husband was agreeing with her. And every time he'd just start sighing. He just kept sighing and sighing. And finally she said, "Dear, aren't you happy here?" He said, "Oh, I love it here. It's the most beautiful place I've ever seen. I can't believe that we're here." And she said, "Well, what's the problem?" "I can't help thinking, if you hadn't made me eat all that fiber, we'd have been here sooner." I want to talk about a well-known parable this morning. I want to talk about the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man and Lazarus, which is in the 16th chapter. This is a very unique parable because Jesus does talk a little bit about heaven in the parable, and he also talks about hell in the same parable. Now, Jesus did talk about heaven and hell. As a matter of fact, he talked about hell more than he did heaven. And he talked about them in the same discussion sometimes, but as far as I know, this is the only parable where he mentions both of these destinations for man. It comes at the tail end of a discourse that he's made to the Pharisees. In chapter 15, they have gotten upset with him. They have murmured among themselves because he's eating with sinners and tax collectors and all these horrible people. And Jesus looks at them and he says, "Well, let me tell you some stories here." And he goes on to tell him the stories of the lost sheep and the shepherd who goes out and finds that lost sheep and the lost coin and the woman who cleans out her house and finds that lost coin. And then he tells him the story about the lost son and how the son came to himself and came back home. The prodigal son is what we know that as. And then in the 16th chapter, he begins with another parable. And this one, it states, he told it to his disciples. But now the Pharisees were there, so they heard this particular parable as well. It was the parable of the unjust steward, the steward who the master found out was not really doing what he was supposed to be doing. And so the steward went around and he made friends with the people who were the underlings, the people who had owed the master and all of these things. And Jesus actually commended him for that because he went out and at least tried to do something so that he wouldn't, you know, be begging the rest of his life. And at the very end of it is where Jesus tells them this particular statement that we have at the end of the reading that I had this morning. No household servant can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or love the one and have contempt for the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And then it goes on to pointedly say that the Pharisees were lovers of money. And in this particular passage, this particular version, it says that they sneered at Jesus. And others, it might say that they sneered at him or some other thing. They derided him. The word there that is used for sneer or derided or whatever, the Greek word means to turn up your nose, to turn up your nose, to scoff, to sneer. In other words, no matter how you put it, they had an arrogant attitude toward Jesus for what he was saying. And that arrogant attitude was born of the fact that they were indeed lovers of money, lovers of something other than God, and that's what was pulling them away. And that's where Jesus turns to them later on and he says, "God knows your hearts." And you can almost imagine Jesus pointing his fingers at him like that. You know, God knows your hearts. You may think that you're something. You may think that you have the esteem of men because you're wealthy. You may think that you have the esteem of men because you're powerful. You may be depending on that money and that position that you have, but God knows your heart. And God knows that you're trying to serve. You're trying to put both ends against the middle, whatever it is. You're trying to serve two masters. You're trying to serve God and yourself. That's basically what you're doing, not just God and mammon, but God and yourself. And I wanted to talk about that last portion of it in context of the parable itself. So let's read the parable, beginning in verse 19. There was a certain rich man who clothed himself in purple and fine linen, and who feasted luxuriously every day. At his gate lay a certain poor man named Lazarus, who was covered with sores. Lazarus longed to eat the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table. Instead, dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried by angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. While being tormented in the place of the dead, he looked up and saw Abraham at a distance with Lazarus at his side. He shouted, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I'm suffering in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that during your lifetime you received good things, whereas Lazarus received terrible things. Now Lazarus is being comforted. You're in great pain. Moreover, a great crevasse has been fixed between us and you. Those who wish to cross over from here to you cannot, neither can anyone cross from here to there, or there to us." The rich man said, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house. I have five brothers. He needs to warn them so they don't come to this place of agony." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. They must listen to them." The rich man said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will change their hearts and lives." Abraham said, "If they don't listen to Moses and the prophets, then neither will they be persuaded if someone rises from the dead." Now, there are some people out there who believe that this story is a true story, that Jesus was telling about an event that actually happened, that there was a rich man and a man named Lazarus, and that all of these events occurred. I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, and I don't necessarily think that you need to believe that to think about this story. The story told by Jesus here was pointed directly at the Pharisees. And that is the first thing that we need to remember. And the second thing that we need to remember about this story is that it was focusing on their attitude and their focus, and that we don't need to have an attitude and a focus like theirs. Now, as stated, Jesus did warn them that God sees their hearts. But he also issued, I believe, in this parable, three other warnings to them. And the first warning is to beware of the trappings of riches. When you look at the very beginning of this story, this is where you're going to see just how rich this man was. Jesus begins by saying, here was a man who was clothed in purple. Clothed in purple. Purple, as we all know, is that royalty dye, you know, that thing that all royalty wears. They're all dressed in purple. I was looking it up, and purple is a very, very rare dye, or it was back then. It was a very rare dye, and it was the most expensive dye that there was in Bible times. And that's because it was a long and laborious production process to make purple dye. It was made from the liquid of a snail, a Mediterranean Sea snail, one drop at a time. You get one drop from one snail. It's said that in Roman times it took, for 1 pound of dye, 4 million snails. You want to know what slaves were doing in those days? They were getting a drop of liquid out of a snail. That's what they were doing, so they could make purple for these people. The emphasis here is that this man was very, very rich. He could afford to buy, he clothed himself in purple all the time, which means this was very expensive for him. He was very rich and he lived in the lap of luxury. He sat at a sumptuous table all the time. And apparently this man was unconcerned about Lazarus, a beggar who was sitting outside of his house, just wanting the crumbs from his table. It's said here that the dogs came and licked his sores. I always wondered why in the world that was put in there, you know, other than maybe it was a sign of, It was so bad that these dogs came and just mistreated him as well. I kind of like to think of it that maybe it wasn't just that. You know, we all love dogs now because they comfort us and they're friends with us and all this sort of stuff. Well, some of us love our dogs. Some of us don't love our dogs as much as others do. But anyway, that's beside the point. But yeah, I read this story the other day on some source. I can't remember what it was. But this lady had a dog, and this dog was hit by a car. So she went out, and you know, the dog was dying. And she was sitting on the curb with her dog, holding him and crying for him. And the dog was whimpering and, you know, was slowly dying. And his last act was to reach up to her face and lick off her tears. Isn't that a sweet story? You know, very comforting. I don't know if that's what that was, but here were these dogs who were licking the sores of Lazarus. The implication of this story is that this rich man did not use his riches to benefit someone else. More than that, he didn't even try. He didn't even care about this beggar who was at his doorstep. The other day, I was going to Walmart to get something, and there was a lady out there who was begging. You ever seen any of those people outside of grocery stores begging? One time, there was one lady outside of Kroger, and she was asking for food for her, or money for food, and I went in and bought her a basket of groceries and came out. I don't think she appreciated it, because I don't think that's what she was there for. But the manager of Walmart chased that lady away before I came out, so I didn't get the chance to decide whether I wanted to give her money or not. I probably would have. But you know, here's this beggar, and he's outside of this rich man's door every day. And the rich man does absolutely nothing for him. He didn't care. I wonder if the Pharisees, while they were listening to that story, identified themselves at all with this rich man. They, as Jesus said, were lovers of money. Now, they were sort of rich in regard that they had more money than the average person did. They were considered maybe what we would think of as upper middle class. Joseph of Arimathea was a very rich man. He lent the tomb for Jesus to be buried in. Jesus' unspoken warning here to these people is to beware of how these riches, not the riches themselves, there's nothing wrong with being rich. There's nothing wrong with having a lot of money. It's what you do with it. It's allowing the riches to control you. It is allowing the riches to change you. Ecclesiastes 5:19 says, "As every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is a gift from God." If we consider the riches that we have, and we mention this every Sunday almost when we're up here and we do the Lord's Supper, we do the collection, we always talk about how blessed we are and how rich we are. And, you know, I've been to Haiti, and a lot of y'all have been to places that are very poor. And you've seen real poverty, and you understand how rich we really are here. But if you can look at these riches as the gift of God, which they are, it can help us to adjust our attitudes a little bit easier. It can help us to look at other people through different eyes. Proverbs chapter 15, verses 15 and 16 says, "All the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure with trouble." Isn't it interesting that Solomon mentions a feast in connection with great riches in this particular passage? Solomon mentions that there is a merry heart and it causes a continual feast. How much better would it have been for the rich man's feast if he had taken the time to share just a little bit of it with Lazarus? How much richer would he have been in his life if he had shared that with this man? And by the way, I'm sure it wasn't just Lazarus he wasn't sharing it with. I'm sure it was anyone he came in contact with that he wasn't sharing it with as well. Riches are a gift for us to use for the service of God. And Jesus alludes to that in the parable of the talents. You remember that? Paul emphasizes it in his letter to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, chapter 6, verses 17 through 19. He said, "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, like the Pharisees, not to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." In the play The Matchmaker, written by Thornton Wilder, the character Horace Van de Gelder said this: "Money is like manure. It's not worth a thing unless it's spread around, encouraging things to grow." That's a pretty good attitude about money. And it's great sentiment, and it dovetails with my next point. The Pharisees weren't just rich in money. They were rich in the knowledge of God. They were rich in their religious life as well. But instead of spreading that around, they lorded it over the people. They kept those people in spiritual shackles. They made them do things that were tradition. They made them do things that weren't really there and commanded by God. Later, Peter spoke about this in context of the instructions to the elders in 1 Peter chapter 5. "Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those who are entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock." It was up to the Pharisees to be able to give those crumbs to the people who were looking for guidance, to the people who were looking for God, to the people who were looking for hope. And you can compare those people to Lazarus in this particular story. They were outside the religious elite, these people were. They longed for the crumbs of mercy and for the crumbs of grace and hope. And that explains why it says what it says in Luke chapter 16 and verse 16, when it says, Jesus says, "The law and the prophets were until John. Since that time, the kingdom of God has been preached, and everyone is pressing into it." The word for pressing there means to apply force. They are moving into it. The people who were hearing Jesus' message were excited about it. They wanted to hear more. They wanted to learn more about God. They wanted to learn more about that mercy. They wanted to be a part of that. They wanted to be accepted. But they were left out as far as the Pharisees and Sadducees and all these religious authorities. They were way down there. They couldn't be as high up as us. But Jesus says, yes, you can. You know, when I think about these particular things, sometimes I think about monasteries and nunneries. You ever really thought about those particular things? You know, these are people that are spending their entire lives doing nothing but studying about God. What are they doing? Who are they helping? What crumbs are they giving out to anyone out there in the world? What is the point of doing all this? Christians who insulate themselves, by the way, do the same things. Christians who are so busy worrying about if every T is crossed and I is dotted, they're doing exactly the same thing to a certain degree. Because they're not showing the love of Jesus. They're not reaching out to others. Beware of the trappings of both secular and spiritual riches, is what Jesus was saying, because they can deceive you, and they can blind you, and they can make you more sure of yourself than you really should be, and they can make you unaware of what may befall you at some time. You know, the rich man had it all, didn't he? And Lazarus had absolutely nothing. But Lazarus at least was making some kind of an effort to get something. At least he was trying to get some help, but the rich man was satisfied. He didn't really care at all. Of course, that reminds us of another parable that was in Luke chapter 12, where Jesus talks about the rich man who was so satisfied and had all of these things and had more than he needed, that instead of helping others, instead of using those riches, he decided that he was going to build bigger barns. And what was it Jesus said? God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided?" The riches that he had, and which this rich man in this parable had, made him satisfied. And worse than that, made him complacent. And that's where the Pharisees were. They had reached a plateau of learning and power. They wanted to hold on to what they had. They wanted to hold on to their position and their money. They didn't particularly want to grow, and they didn't want to become better people, as it were, or more spiritual people. They were complacent. They were satisfied with where they were. And complacency can be a killer. Benjamin E. Mays, civil rights leader, said this: "The tragedy of life is often not in our failure, but rather in our complacency. Not in our doing too much, but rather in our doing too little." not in living above our ability, but rather in our living below our capacities. And those are very true words. Very, very true words. This was where the rich man was. Complacency had closed his eyes to the beggar that was lying at his door, right there in front of him. Complacency had closed his eyes to kindness. Complacency had closed his eyes to compassion. Complacency had closed his eyes to using the gifts that God had given him, and had closed his eyes to God. It's easy to be complacent, isn't it? I've gotten complacent before, and I found out that's not the way to be. But it's a very easy thing to do, and it's not where we're headed when we begin some type of activity. It happens over a long period of time. When we stop watching, we stop striving. We become satisfied with who we are and where we are and what we're doing. We lose focus when that happens. We become settled in our ways. But that's not how God wants us to be. He wants us to use our talents that He's given us, our riches, whether it's spiritual or secular, or whether it's I can do this and somebody else can't do that, so I'm going to use those talents. Whatever it is, He wants us to use those. And He wants us to grow those talents and develop new ones. And that's obviously the message of the parable of the talents mentioned earlier. We don't grow complacent with what we have. We strive to learn more. We strive to grow more. We strive to use more of what God has given us. And even if we fail, if we're doing what God has asked us to do, and we're doing it for the reasons God asks us, it is rewarding to our souls. There's a song that is out, I don't know how old it is, but I thought it was a very great song every time I hear it, except that they repeat the same verses 47 times in the song, so it gets a little old. But the short verses they have are pretty good. It's called Called Me Higher. I could just sit and wait for all your goodness, hope to feel your presence, and I could just stay right where I am and hope to feel you, hope to feel something again. And I could hold on to who I am and never let you change me from the inside. And I could be safe, oh, I could be safe here in your arms and never leave home, never let these walls down. But you have called me higher, you have called me deeper, and I'll go where you lead me, Lord. You have called me higher, you have called me deeper, and I'll go where you lead me, Lord, where you lead me, where you lead me, Lord. Are we going to be satisfied with who we are and what we have? Or are we going to strive for more? Or are we going to strive for more spirituality? Or are we going to strive for more opportunities to work for the Lord? Or are we going to strive to grow? The trappings of complacency seemingly will make us comfortable. But ultimately, and perhaps eternally, they will make us uncomfortable. And that's where the rest of this parable goes. Not much more is said about the rich man and Lazarus and that little part of their life. Eventually, both die, and Lazarus is taken by the angels into heaven. The rich man opens his eyes in hell. And now the shoe is on the other foot. Now it's the rich man who is begging for some kind of a mercy. Father Abraham, just let him dip his finger in water and put it on my tongue so that I can be cooled from all this. But Abraham answers, you know, we can't do anything. Can't do anything at all. There is a great gulf that has been fixed between us. You know what else was fixed here on earth? There was a great gulf that rich man put between himself and Lazarus, wasn't there? And he would not cross that gulf. And now there's a gulf that separates him from the mercy of God, but no one can bridge that gulf. No one at all. The rich man asked for Abraham to send Lazarus back from the dead so that he can talk to his brothers and warn them. And of course, Abraham says that wouldn't do any good. They have Moses and the prophets. They need to listen to them. And besides that, there is no exit from eternity. Not from heaven. And not from hell, for those in heaven are hell. And besides, the brothers wouldn't listen to him anyway. You know how we know about that, by the way? Not too long after this parable, a real man named Lazarus died. And 4 days later was brought back from the dead. And the Pharisees wanted to kill him because of what had happened. They didn't believe. Someone once said, if you board the train of unbelief, You'll have to take it all the way to its destination. And those are true words. I wish I could say I said it, but somebody else said it, so I can't take credit for it. Once you die, there's no changing cars. Jesus is making a pointed accusation to these Pharisees. They are lovers of money. They are lovers of power. They are lovers of self. And they were the ones who overlooked the ones who needed God most. But they weren't doing it. They were overlooking them. They weren't overlooking them. They were overlooking them. It is a pointed condemnation of their attitude of pridefulness, just like the rich man in the parable. He was warning them that they were headed for the same fate if they didn't change their ways. You have to ask at this point, what is hell like? What was it like for that rich man in hell? Jesus said that the rich man opened his eyes and he was in torment. He was in agony from the flames. Other places talk about the eternal fire, the furnace of fire. In Revelation, it talks about the lake of fire. A lot of fire involved. And of course, we can't be sure if it's going to be actual fire or if it's something else. We won't know unless we're actually there. And I'm going to tell you something. I don't want to find out. I don't want to know. I'll just trust the scriptures and trust what people say. But I can tell you this, whatever it is, it's a lonely place. Remember the commercials about the Maytag repairman, the loneliest man in town? He wasn't because there was a camera crew right here, you know, all these people. But, you know, it's lonely. You ever been lonely? You ever been alone and you really were lonely? Let me tell you something. The rich man woke up in torment, and it doesn't talk about his fellow tormentees. It just talks about the rich man. There was no one there to comfort him. There was no one there to say, it's okay, it'll be all right. He was there by himself. And there was Lazarus in Abraham's bosom. He had been escorted to heaven by angels, and he was in the presence of God. He was not lonely. The rich man was alone. No friends, no enemies either. Will the fire be flames licking your body, or are they going to be fires of regret? Have you ever regretted anything in your life? Do y'all have regrets from your life? You know, I wish I hadn't done that. I can tell you, well, some of them I can't tell you. But there are a lot of things in my life I regret. And sometimes they come back. And, that, you know, that's Satan actually working sometimes, you know, regretting all this stuff. But sometimes they come back and you regret things. Well, imagine that you have forever and ever 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 to regret not becoming a part of the Lord's body, not doing the things that God told you to do, and knowing that you could have done it if you'd made that choice. You are regretting that. Can you imagine that would be a fire burning in your heart and in your soul? The trappings of hell are everlasting regret and remorse, with no hope of anything else. Beware the trappings of riches, both secular and spiritual. They will lead you to trappings of complacency if you allow them, and that can lead you to the trappings of hell. Solomon said this, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all." The Pharisees, who knew these verses, had lost sight of the advice from Solomon. They had begun to believe their own press. They'd begun to believe they were who they thought they were. They began to believe them in themselves more than in the Father. And this parable was pointed to move them out of that direction. There are so many today who are in the same boat. They have all the answers, and in some cases, they seem to know more than God knows. They can tell you who's wrong, and they can tell you who's right, and they can tell you why they're wrong and why they're right, because their tradition says this. While they feast before God, there are people at their door who are begging for the Word of God, begging for the crumbs of the spiritual life, begging to be let in to the feast, but they're left out in the cold. Others have grown complacent in their lives. They are willing to sit back and they are willing to be comfortable, unable or unwilling to stretch beyond what they have and what they see as their limits and trust God's providence and care and guidance. We are so rich, not just in this country. You know, if you talk to John Robert and you sit down and talk to him about all this, he will tell you he's rich. He's in the poorest country in the southern hemisphere, but he's rich because he knows Jesus. And he shares Jesus. I've told you this before. He has a dual citizenship. He could be here in the United States making lots of money. But he chooses to serve in Port-au-Prince. He chooses to serve his fellow Haitians. Because that is what he feels he has been called to do. We are rich. Whether we're poor or rich, we're rich. In material things and in spiritual things. And the warning of Jesus is, don't allow yourself to fall into the trappings of richness and into the trappings of complacency, because you don't want to be and see the trappings of hell. This morning, if you have a need to answer an invitation, we're going to offer that to you right now while we stand and sing.